Welcome to the latest episode of The Grower and The Economist. I'm Michelle Klieger, The Economist.
And I'm Peter Kanjoyan, The Grower.
Each week, we team up to tackle the biggest challenges facing small and medium-sized growers. We're one part grower and one part economist, just like your business. Welcome to The Grower and The Economist. This week, Peter and I are talking about education. Besides this podcast, we want to make sure that you, the listeners, have other tools and resources that we find extremely important and valuable to our businesses and as we talk with different growers.
And you know, Michelle, it's an interesting topic because we're always learning and never stop learning. You know, that the grower that I run across that acts like he or she knows everything and has everything figured out, those are the ones that we end up worrying about. So I think it's a wonderful topic. I will come at this from a more traditional angle, having been involved in cooperative extension and the academic community. So I'll kind of introduce and we can point people in directions on as commercial growers, how they can get information and further their education. And then I'm guessing that you have some interesting avenues that you can suggest in the field of economics.
Yes, I do. I think that there are other resources, especially from the USDA and those extension budgets that I spend a lot of time reading. Yeah, I think that this is an important topic because, you know, we are seeing an influx of interest from outside of traditional agriculture. We've talked with other guests before about how they're getting people involved that didn't grow up on a family farm. And so just the fundamental role that education and research plays is so critical. And I just want to highlight that for a minute and make sure that we're giving it the credit it's due in how much our, university systems have and public research has accomplished since, being founded.
Yes. Well, it's fascinating. Let's go back in time and just give a little history of how our cooperative extension and state university system did evolve or come into being. And it was President Abraham Lincoln that established the Land Grant University Act. Was it the Morrow Act? I believe so. Yes. So each of our 50 states has a land grant university. So that would be in most states here for you and me. It's the University of Massachusetts to University of Maryland. We got Purdue.
UMass Amherst?
It is.
Oh, I read that MIT was the original land grant and that they made themselves private. So I was curious if Massachusetts was the only state without one now.
Oh, okay. Well, no, it's not. This is really good. So you have a little more accurate picture of the history here in Massachusetts. I wasn't aware of MIT being assigned originally, but it is UMass now because that's where our cooperative extension service is based. My undergraduate work at UNH, New Hampshire's land grant there. So in most states, Michelle, Penn State, Ohio State, the one that's a little bit of an exception is, and it might surprise people, that in New York State, it's Cornell. And Cornell's an Ivy League institution, but it's also New York's land grant institution. So that's where the agriculture program is based. We've got colleagues out there that are conducting the same type of horticultural research that you and I discuss all the time. So that's an exception, but in most states, it's the University of.
Well, as long as we're throwing around trivia, I would add then that in Indiana, it's Purdue. South Carolina, it is Clemson. So
now, one other interesting thing, just as introductory comments, if anyone's ever wondering, for instance, in Pennsylvania, why Penn State University is like in the middle of the boondocks, it's not near any city. I suspect most of our land grant institutions were located in a central place within each state so that everybody could have equal access. So UMass Amherst being, halfway across the state. So there was some rhyme and reason to it back then that today, when my kids went to Penn State, it was often said that on football Saturdays, State College, Pennsylvania is the third largest municipality or city in the state of Pennsylvania. So that's how the land grant university system got started. Each of these programs will have applied agriculture and horticulture, as you and I went through programs in our various institutions. And then an outbreak or an overflow of that was the formation of what we call the Cooperative Extension Service. Usually refer to that as the university's outreach program. Professors conducting research on campus, teaching undergrad, advising graduate students. And we needed a way to get that information translated and funneled out to growers. And we learned very quickly that growers are not interested or trained to digest publications that researchers would publish with peer review and whatnot. So a cooperative extension service, one of the main objectives or tasks is to translate that laboratory grade research into everyday grower friendly information. So we usually discuss research as being in one of two camps. One is called basic research, and that's the high-powered laboratory research. And then we refer to a lower level of research as applied research. And that's where we would look at different fertilizer levels or different fertilizer products and pick the best ones so that we can suggest to co-farmers and growers which products perform better and which don't. So that's kind of how cooperative extension unfolded. And across any state, Michelle, we have university-based state extension specialists. So in most universities, that is a PhD that's housed on campus, and he or she conducts research, oversees outreach. But then spread around the state, there are county agents. And most often, the county agent is at a master's degree level, something a little bit higher, but rarely a PhD. And the county agents are the boots on the ground. They're the ones who are interacting closely with the growers. So that's how the system kind of evolved, unfolded. It's pretty efficient. And with modern technology and the last decade or two with internet and web-based learning, we're finding that it's much easier for a university extension program to now reach beyond its state borders.
And I think we heard that from some of our previous guests, that using technology for grower outreach for the last year has helped them develop and refine their digital resources to communicate. And as soon as it's online, it's much easier to have a voice outside of your state to a broader area. And many of these topics are applicable in more than just one small area.
Yes, well put. And historically, if we have listeners who are of my generation and being in my mid-60s, the more traditional approach, those of my generation, Michelle, will think back and can recall very easily how back in that day, prior to the web, each state's program, well, neighboring states would compete with one another. For instance, in the 70s, when I was in grad school at Ohio State, there was quite a competition between Ohio State and Michigan State in terms of the research that we did and the outreach that we performed. And we each had state associations, and there was healthy competition between the two. Now, those state boundaries have been broken down. And I think on the whole, the university system's becoming a little more efficient in that there's less redundancy. Every state now doesn't have to have a complete program.
That makes a lot of sense. But I will hold that there's probably still a strong football rivalry between those schools. So while there are some barriers broken down, not all of them will dissipate.
Correct. In some of the supporting disciplines, Michelle, this has become even more important. For instance, entomology and plant pathology. Now, we don't need to have a plant pathologist at every land-grant institution. We can have three or four or half a dozen, maybe a dozen around the country. Between the pathologists and the entomologists, we can get the job done. And in the past, there were many pathologists and entomologists around the country, but only a handful that would show up, Michelle, on all of the conference programs. So in another way, it's made it a little more efficient. You might be seeing the same thing in the field of in your field of ag economics.
I have. Last spring, Kansas State University, they have a workshop every year where it's on campus generally, and professors and students that are doing research are able to present for 2 days. And so they moved it online, and I would have never gone, but I was suddenly able to go. And not only go, but with the recordings being taped, I was also able to watch them when I had time. And so this was a resource that I never would have used that proved to be extremely valuable. And then I would take it a step further. When you see these people online, they don't always feel accessible, but I was able to email several people that gave presentations and just dive deeper into their research. So not only are we, you know, making it easier to share that information more broadly, there also seem to be more opportunities to engage with the researchers, you know, to dig a little bit deeper and see how this directly answers questions about your business or operation.
That's another excellent point. And it's one that's continuing to evolve. Michelle, any of us as researchers and educators, when we're speaking at conferences, one of the most fun parts of a presentation for us, and you probably would agree with this as well, it's the question and answer period at the end. It's after the formal presentation's over and you're moving out into the hallway and you have half a dozen growers who have specific questions they want to ask. And it's perfect opportunity to break down any of the barrier between researcher and grower. Now, not all of our colleagues, Michelle, are accessible and personable enough. So, you know, you have to have enough respect and allow them to, you know, be a little standoffish if they need to. But how many times over my career, Michelle, and I credit having grown up on a farm and being a grower for what I'm about to say, how many times I've had growers come up to me after a conference presentation and say, Dr. Kanjoyan, I just want to thank you for not speaking over our heads and to speak and for speaking to us in a way we can understand. And you and I have colleagues where we know that they try to talk very in complicated to make it look like they're really smart, but that's really not the way to help our growers. And you know, I always say if the grower isn't your primary objective, helping the grower, then please move to botany where you don't have to interact with the growers.
No, I think that's great insight. I guess my question is, why? Why do you want to do this research? And from that place of why you do the research, does that explain why growers should come to you for advice? I'm interested in this trustworthiness feature and just having that agriculture background, because I do feel like there are a lot of voices right now. And sometimes it's helpful that there are extension and that there's government outreach, and then there's probably nonprofit outreach and company outreach. And so there's a lot of places that you can get information, but understanding why someone shows up is a key piece. So as an extension agent or as a researcher, how do you pick your research and why does that necessarily translate into benefits for growers?
Okay, this is going to be fun to talk about. And you're going to keep bringing us back to the question, okay? Because before I answer the question, I'm going to make an observation. And as we just talked about the university system, land grant system becoming more efficient and consolidating, there's a spillover now, Michelle, of PhDs from the academic community to the private sector. So I'm one of them. I chose to start my career in the university as a university professor and then decided that the private sector is where I wanted to raise my family. So we have more and more each year PhDs coming to the private sector directly from graduate school. So that means they're going to end up working for companies, either large or small, and some of them are going to be more aligned with the sales side of a company than with an R&D side. So now we have to be careful. And when you brought up the word trustworthiness, it's appropriate because now growers, as you say, they can look to different places to get their information. So I'm going to try to tie this part of the conversation to a little bow by saying we believe that there is still less bias in research and outreach that comes from our university researchers. And we certainly have reputable researchers in the private sector. I hope I qualify as being one of them. We're not being tied to a product or a brand or a company. I've been very careful, Michelle, in the private sector with the companies and products I choose to work with, and have to make it clear whenever a company comes to me to make it clear to them that I'm not participating in the sales of their product. I'm merely R&D. And it's something, my reputation is something that I've guarded very closely and fiercely over the years. A couple of times I've stepped just a bit over the line and had friends and colleagues say, be careful, Peter, and I've pulled back to make sure I stay away from sales. So your point is excellent. They have to be careful in the private sector and know who the researcher's working for. Now, there are plenty of independent consultants, and it's up to the grower to find the right ones. And I'd say, Michelle, that those researchers that we see on programs and read articles in magazines, that's kind of a qualifier, helps growers understand that this is an unbiased opinion.
Yeah, and it just feels like that sometimes the companies are really helpful. I was on the King Arthur website, and they have thousands of recipes and tips on flour. And so King Arthur is a baking company, and they supply a lot of flours that you can, you know, milled flours that you can get in the store. And so with their product, because they're so customer facing, they sell all of the tools that go with it, and they have cookbooks and tips, and you can call and ask them any question. And so for the entry level person, this is really important. It got me thinking about Johnny's has a very similar approach where they do have a lot of this information and outreach. They also represent lots of brands. So it's kind of interesting, those trustworthy sources sort of ebb and flow, and it depends on where you are. And I think that as you graduate from being, you know, a hobby into being your business, that you're right, that more disconnected, that more foundational university doesn't have skin in the game makes a lot of sense on why that's where growers go for their information.
Yeah. So I'd say at this point in our conversation, I would point fellow growers to their land grant university, learn who their researchers are, perhaps beyond their state in their region, get to know their cooperative extension service. That would be my first resource. And then with the qualifying comments, certainly the private sector. Most of our audience, Michelle, you and I are geared towards small and medium-sized growers. Most of them are not going to be able to hire one-on-one PhD consultants. The consulting is taking place at those large greenhouse ranges and farms. So if they can't get one-on-one time, most often, as you say, they can find themselves after a conference presentation. Most of my colleagues will give their contact information on a slide, and they will welcome one-on-one contact. If I have a grower that contacts me after a conference, Michelle, and then he or she is, you know, sent email after email and week after week, there's a point where I have to say to them, I'm happy to answer today's question, but this is how I make my living. So if you want to continue or going beyond this, then we have to do a little bit of a consulting fee. And I hope you can appreciate what I'm saying. Up to now, I've been happy to answer your questions. So we learn how to read the landscape.
And where does your newsletter fit in?
The newsletter, Michelle, was such an exciting time in my career. I don't write it any longer, but this was during the late 80s and early 90s, where I was deeply involved in ethylene research with a growth regulator. Active ingredient was called Ethifon, and we would spray Ethifon on a plant, and as it penetrated the foliage, it would release ethylene inside the tissue. most of us, most of our growers understand ethylene as a bad hormone, encourages ripening and senescence and whatnot. But I was able to kind of stumble on some beneficial effects of ethylene, which include stimulation of plant branching, delay of flower initiation so that we can control flowering, and inhibits internode elongation. So I learned how to harness it. So we got compact branch plants and timed flowering to when growers wanted it. And that information, it was just so good coming out of the research experiments that I started a newsletter in the early 90s. And my wife would help me. We'd photocopy it right here in the office and mail it. And I got that subscription list up to 960 growers around the country and Canada. My goal had been 1,000. You and I have talked about how up to recently there were about 10,000 greenhouse operations in the country. So I figured if 10% I had on my... And back then in the 90s, Michelle, it was unheard of. The subscription fee for this newsletter was $100 a year. And it was because the growers realized that that investment paid them dividends in terms of not having to pinch crops and being able to time things. So it was a once in a career research project that then supported this newsletter. And it also supported a day-long workshop, Michelle, that I traveled around the country. I'd call a friend who had a greenhouse operation in Seattle and say, would you host it with me? And we'd have 50 growers come, and that day's registration was $150. So if the research is good, Michelle, growers will understand it and they'll realize the value of it. That newsletter wouldn't happen today. It would all be done online and virtual instead of workshop. But it was such an exciting time in my life and career. And I still have growers that write to me and with questions on this product.
I guess. And then how do you use the community? So if you are a small grower, right, we don't necessarily facilitate a community at this point, but presumably you know other small or medium-sized growers in the industry. Are those experiences and those conversations an important part? Do they happen organically, or do you need some kind of association to encourage that mixing?
My answer to that question, Michelle, is I don't care how small you are as a grower. Getting involved with your local grower association, which oftentimes is at a county level. So here in Massachusetts, I started my career off on the board of Essex County Florists Association here north and east of, oh, north and west of Boston. And then once I joined the association, it didn't take long to be invited to join the board of directors. And then once you're active on your local or county board, then it doesn't take long for your state grower association to notice you. So you then rise to the state level as an association member, then as either a committee member or a board of directors. And there's nothing intimidating about being on a board of directors, Michelle. So I don't want any grower listening to this to feel, oh, I may not have enough to offer. Everyone has something to offer. And let me help our small growers that listen understand the following. My operation at a little over an acre is always qualified as a small, maybe just tickling the low side of medium operation. And over my career, as I rose up through local to state to region to national, I got to the point at my national contribution, which was through the Ohio Florists Association, that's now American Horn. It ended that I could look around and sit at tables with board of directors and committees and look at top 100 growers, high profile individuals, men and women, whose businesses dwarfed mine. But I gained enough confidence. They welcomed me enough to know that I could sit across the table from them and we had equal say in what we were doing. So I'd never want to hear a fellow grower who says, I'm too small to make a contribution. We are all in it together. The reason for your question is, let's give them the confidence so that they can search out their associations. I find fewer and fewer growers who operate with a closed shop or a closed door model anymore. And that tends to be more of the older set, my generation, that says, I don't want anyone coming here. I don't want them to see what I'm doing. I'm not going to share anything, nor do they go out anywhere else. So we're kind of leaving that model in the past.
That feels like an important evolution for the industry. It's interesting that it's both, don't want anybody to visit my shop and I won't visit others, that it's closed off both ways. We can learn so much from each other.
Yes. Bring up a good point. I think I overgeneralized there. Some of this set is of the mindset, don't come here, I'm not going to share this, but, oh, by the way, I'm going to come in and learn whatever I can from you. That element as well, that operates as in a selfish way. Quick little story on to illustrate that. My dad, during the height of this Ethathon project through the 90s, kept saying to me, why are you sharing all of this information? Everybody's going to learn how to do this. And I kind of get to him and say, Dad, that's the point. It's the point to help everybody be better. He wasn't terrible at that, but yeah, he would say it to me, whispered in my ear occasionally. I know that as he saw newsletters and workshops, there was a pride that he felt as well. Every now and then that old philosophy would bubble up. So searching out your local associations, Michelle, again, with technology, you're not limited anymore to just your state association. There's something going on in the Indiana Greenhouse Growers Association that interests me in Pennsylvania or in Michigan. Well, I can join that association. They'd welcome me and have more access to their doing.
Did you ever feel like you didn't have enough time? We talked a lot about how many different hats small growers have to wear. And so making time to go to association meetings, let alone be on the board, feels like an easy barrier that a lot of people would run into.
I think what you're saying is accurate, that that is an excuse that many growers will use. But here's where, you know, I'll take off my grower hat and put on my professor or researcher hat and say, you have to make the time to educate yourself. There is no excuse for not taking advantage of the programs that are out there. And if they're offered online, you don't even have to travel anymore. So it's a good point, Michelle, but it's one that I'll refuse to acknowledge or them. That's where I'll start wagging a finger and pulling rank and saying, no, I don't want to hear that. What I often say at conferences, and I think you and I may have covered this from time to time, I'll speak to an audience and say, you know, it's not you who show up that I worry about. It's those who don't make the time to come that aren't going to end up being as competitive. I guess that's my answer to your question. There's no excuse for not taking advantage of the extension programming.
Well, and the easier one from an economic perspective to explain would be your workshop like the one you gave in Seattle. Can you, as a grower, get $150 out of value out of it, or even $150 plus your time for the day? Then you would obviously want to go because you're getting more value out of it than you are being charged. I think that the harder examples would be on the being involved where you don't actually know when you're going to get those tangible returns, right? I mean, I paid $25 or $50 to go to the University of New Hampshire aquaponics workshop that you and I met at, right? So there was a low barrier to entry. I made the time I went. I don't know that I knew what was going to come out of it, but just those are the harder ones to justify going in because you don't know what you're going to expect and you can't guess what's going to come out of it. And I am guessing that over time, as you built that list or as you went to more meetings, you went to meetings and you built your list and then you kept in touch with those people and then, you know, maybe it turned into work. So going to these meetings, I think, has twofold of an advantage, right? One, it helps you understand what's going on in the industry to better your operation. And two, it furthers your network, which might either improve your day-to-day efficiency or find partners or new opportunities and that unknown that is hard to justify, but I think anybody that networks will tell you it's there.
Oh, it's so true. Everything you said is just spot on, Michelle. One, many, many will say, if I go to this conference or if I go on this grower tour, All I need to do is find one thing, learn one thing, and that made the whole day and my time worth it. Most of the time, Michelle, it's not one thing. They may need two hands to count everything that they've learned. What are some other life responsibilities where, oh, I don't want to do it, I don't want to do it, I don't, oh, I'm so glad I just did that. Now, another generality, touched on this a few minutes ago, as much of the formal education that will take place in a seminar room, as important as that is, many of us will say to you, in the hallway or on the trade show floor, education is even more beneficial. Where if I hear that researcher that we talked about 10 minutes ago with his or her presentation on growth regulators or insect control, and then I see him or her on the trade show floor, and they're accessible, wow, there's so much more I'll learn in about 5 minutes of conversation, and he or she will then tailor the comments to what I'm describing as my situation. The other generality, Michelle, and again, you brought up the word trustworthy earlier. The trustworthy part of this is, okay, I want our listeners, I want my fellow growers to trust what I'm saying, that if you make the effort to contribute at your county, state, national level, if you make that investment, I have yet to hear a fellow grower end a term on a board of directors at any level and not come away and say, this was one of the best experiences of my professional career. I don't care who it is, how much education they do or do not have. It's a self-improvement. It's an investment in your business. I often say to young folks, Michelle, getting into college and graduate school, get as much education as you can. You're investing in yourself. Surer bet can you make than putting money on yourself. Go to these conferences, learn, and give back. Make that contribution. It's so often when at the higher levels, members are rolling off boards of directors, and I've been one several times, you're often given a few minutes as your term expires and your last board meeting is coming to a conclusion to share some of your experience or how you feel about the experience serving on the board. And again, I have yet to hear one person not gush with how superlatives what he or she learned. You also used the word networking a moment ago, Michelle. That is invaluable. How we even put a price or a dollar figure on the networking. The grower in Seattle that hosted the workshop that I described earlier has sat with my parents and me in my mother's kitchen having lunch when he was in the area on vacation and looked us up. He's a top 100 grower, and it was back in the 90s considered one of the two best garden centers in the United States. And for him to search out my small family business, and his story, Michelle, was identical to my parents. Immigrant parents that came. He started a greenhouse business, had a farm beforehand. It's the same story. It's terribly exciting. I thank you for bringing this topic up so we can share it with our listeners. It's wonderful. It's emotional. It got lots of meat and potatoes in it.
Well, and as we would wrap up, I think that one of our goals is to be that source of information. So the bringing our networks together, bringing people and businesses that we think will help, is designed to show listeners new resources and provide them information to improve their businesses. So I think that by and large, it's fair to say that the people that we have on this show, we are bringing to you because we think that they are a valuable source of information or valuable areas that you need to consider in your business, and that we are striving to make this show better and better to be of that caliber where it is a trusted resource for you.
Well said, partner.